Just one, little brother. Cardan just stands there.
Pick up the sword.
Balkan's patience is worn thin already. With a long, suffering sigh, Cardan lifts the blade. His stance is terrible. I can see why Balkan is annoyed. Surely Cardan must have been given fighting tutors since he was old enough to hold a stick in his hands. I was taught from the time I got to Faerie, so he'd have had years on me. And the first thing I learned was where to put my feet. Balkan raises his staff.
Now, attack!
For a long moment, they stand still, regarding each other. Cardan swings his sword in a desultory manner, and Balkan brings down his staff hard, smacking him in the side of the head. I wince at the sound of the wood against his skull. Cardan staggers forward, baring his teeth. His cheek and one of his ears is red, all the way to the point.
This is ridiculous,
Cardan says, spitting on the floor.
Why must we play this silly game? Or do you like this part? Is this what makes it fun for you? Swordplay isn't a game.
Balkan swings again. Cardan tries to jump back, but the staff catches at the edge of his thigh. Cardan winces, bringing up his sword defensively.
Then why call it swordplay?
Balkan's face darkens, and his grip on the staff tightens. This time he jabs Cardan in the stomach, striking suddenly and with enough force for Cardan to sprawl on the stone floor.
I have tried to improve you, but you insist on wasting your talents on revels, on being drunk under the moonlight, on your thoughtless rivalries and your pathetic romances.
Cardan pushes himself to his feet and rushes at his brother, swinging his sword wildly. He wields it like a club. The sheer frenzy of the attack makes Balkan fall back a step. Cardan's technique finally shows. He becomes more deliberate, attacking from new angles. He's never shown much interest in swordsmanship at school, and although he knows the basics, I am not sure he practices. Balkan disarms him ruthlessly and efficiently. Cardan's sword flies from his hand, clattering across the floor toward me. I scuttle back deeper into the shadows of the chair. For a moment, I think that I am going to be caught. But the servant is the one to pick up the blade, and his gaze does not waver. Balkan cracks his staff against the back of Cardan's legs, sending him to the ground. I am delighted. There's a part of me that wishes I were the one wielding that staff.
Don't bother to rise.
Balkan unbuckles his belt and hands it over to the servant. The human man wraps it twice around his palm.
You have failed the test. Again.
Cardan doesn't speak. His eyes are glittering with a familiar rage, but for once, it isn't directed at me. He's on his knees, but he doesn't appear in any way cowed.
Tell me.
Belkin's voice has gone silky, and he paces around his younger brother.
When will you cease being a disappointment?
Maybe when you stop pretending that you don't do this for your own pleasure,
Cardan answers.
If you want to hurt me, it would save us both a lot of time if you got right down to...
Father was old and his seed weak when he sired you. That's why you're weak.
Balkan puts one hand on his brother's neck. It looks affectionate until I see Cardan's flinch, the shifting of his balance. That's when I realize Balkan is pressing down hard, pinning Cardan in place on the floor.
Now, take off your shirt and receive your punishment.
Cardan begins to strip off his shirt, showing an expanse of moon-pale skin and a back with a delicate tracery of faded scars. My stomach lurches. They're going to beat him. I should be glorying in seeing Cardan like this. I should be glad that his life sucks, maybe worse than mine, even though he's a prince of Faerie and a horrible jerk and probably going to live forever. If someone had told me that I'd get an opportunity to see this, I would have thought the only thing I'd have to stifle was applause. But watching, I cannot help observing that beneath his defiance is fear. I know what it is to say the clever thing because you don't want anyone to know how scared you are. It doesn't make me like him any better, but for the first time, he seems real. Not good, but real. Balekin nods. The servant strikes twice, the slap of the leather echoing loudly in the still air of the room.
I don't order this because I am angry with you, brother,
Balekin tells Cardin, causing me to shudder.
I do it because I love you. I do it because I love our family.
When the servant lifts his arm to strike a third time, Cardin lunges for his blade, resting on Balekin's desk where the servant put it. For a moment, I think Cardin is going to run the human man straight through. The servant does not cry out or lift his hands to protect himself. Maybe he is too ensorcelled for that. Maybe Cardin could stab him right through the heart, and he wouldn't do a single thing to defend himself. I am weak with horror.
Go ahead,
Balekin says, bored. He makes a vague gesture toward the servant.
Kill him. Show me you don't mind making a mess. Show me that at least you know how to land a killing blow on such a pathetic target as this. I am no murderer, says Cardin,
surprising me. I would not have thought that was something to be proud of. In two strides, Balekin is in front of his brother. They look so alike, standing close. Same inky hair, matching sneers, devouring eyes. But Balekin shows his decades of experience, wrenching the sword from Cardin's hands and knocking him to the ground with the crossbar.
Then take your punishment like the pathetic creature that you are.
Balekin nods to the servant, who rouses from somnolence. I watch every blow, every flinch. I have little choice. I can shut my eyes, but the sounds are just terrible. And worst of all is Cardin's empty face, his eyes as dull as lead. Truly, he has come by his cruelty honestly in Balekin's care. He has been raised up in it, instructed in its nuances, honed through its application. However horrible Cardin might be, I now see what he might become, and am truly afraid. Chapter 13. Disturbingly, it is even easier to gain entrance to the palace of Elfheim in my servant's gown than it was to enter Balekin's household. Everyone, from goblin to the gentry to the High King's mortal court poet and seneschal, barely gives me a passing look as I find my clumsy way through the labyrinthine halls. I am nothing. No one. A messenger no more worthy of attention than an animated twig woman or an owl. My pleasant, placid expression, combined with forward momentum, gets me to Prince Dane's chambers without so much as a second look, even though I lose my way twice and have to retrace my steps. I rap on his door, and I'm relieved when the prince himself opens it. He raises both brows, taking in the sight of me in the homespun dress. I make a formal curtsy, as any servant might. I do not alter my expression, for fear of his not being alone.
Yes,
he asks. I am here with a message for you, Your Highness, I say, hoping that sounds right. I beg for a moment of your time.
You're a natural,
he tells me, grinning.
Come inside.
It's a relief to relax my face. I drop the inane smile as I follow him into his parlor. Furnished in elaborate velvets, silks, and brocades, it's a riot of scarlet and deep blues and greens. Everything rich and dark, like overripe fruit. The patterns on the material are the sorts of things I have become accustomed to. Intricate braids of briars. Leaves that might also be spiders when you looked at them from another angle. And a depiction of a hunt where it is unclear which of the creatures is hunting the other. I sigh and sit down in the chair he is pointing me toward, fumbling in my pocket. Here, I say, drawing out the folded-up note and smoothing it against the top of a cunning little table with carved bird feet for legs. He came in while I was copying it, so it's kind of a mess. I had left the stolen book with the toad. The last thing I want Prince Dane to know is that I took something for myself. Dane squints to see the shapes of the letters past my smudges.
And he didn't see you?
He was distracted, I say truthfully. I hid. He nods and rings a small bell, probably to summon a servant. I will be glad of anyone not ensorcelled.
Good. And did you enjoy it?
I am not sure what to make of that question. I was frightened pretty much the whole time. How is that enjoyable? But the longer I think about it, the more I realize that I did sort of enjoy it. Most of my life is dreadful anticipation, awaiting for the other shoe to drop. At home, in classes, with the court, being afraid I would be caught spying was an entirely new sensation. One where I felt, at least as though I knew exactly what to be scared of. I knew what it would take to win. Sneaking through Balekin's house had been less frightening than some revels. At least until I'd watched Cardin get beaten. Then I'd felt something I don't want to examine too closely. I liked doing a good job, I say, finally finding an honest answer. That makes Dane nod. He's about to tell me something else when another fairy enters the room. A male goblin, scarred, his skin the green of ponds. His nose is long and twists fully around before bending back toward his face like a scythe. His hair is a black tuft at the very crown of his head. His eyes are unreadable. He blinks several times, as though trying to focus on me.
"They call me the Roach,"
he says, his voice melodious, completely at odds with his face. He bows and then cocks the side of his head toward Dane.
"At his service. I guess we both are. You're the new girl, right?"
I nod. Am I supposed to tell you my name, or am I supposed to come up with something clever? The Roach grins, which twists his whole face up even more hideously.
"I am supposed to take you to meet the troop. And don't worry about what we're going to call you. We decide that for ourselves. You think anyone in their right mind would want to be called the Roach?"
"Great," I say, and sigh. He gives me a long look.
"Yeah, I can see how that's a real talent. Not having to say what you mean."
He's dressed in an imitation of a court doublet, except his doublet is made from scraps of leather. I wonder what Matic would say if he knew where I was and with whom. I do not think he would be pleased. I don't think he'd be pleased by anything I did today. Soldiers have a peculiar kind of honor. Even those who dip their caps in the blood of their enemies, sneaking around houses and stealing papers, is not at all in line with it. Even though Matic has spies of his own, I don't think he'd like my being one.
"So he's been blackmailing Queen Orla,"
Dane says, and the Roach and I look over at him. Prince Dane is frowning over the letter, and suddenly I understand. He recognizes my copy of the handwriting. Nicasia's mother, Queen Orla, must be the woman who obtained poison for Balekin. She wrote that she was repaying a debt. Although knowing Nicasia, I would guess a little nastiness wouldn't give her mother much pause. but the Queen of the Underseas Kingdom is vast and mighty. It is hard to imagine what Baelkin could have over her. Dane hands my letter to the Roach.
So do you still believe he will use it before the coronation?
The goblin's nose quivers.
That's the smart move. Once the crown is on your head, nothing's going to get it off.
Until that moment, I hadn't been sure whom the poison was for. I open my mouth and then bite the side of my cheek to stop myself from saying something foolish. Of course it must be for Prince Dane. Whom else would Baelkin need some special poison to kill? If he were going to put regular people to death, he'd probably use some kind of cheap, regular person poison. Dane seems to notice my surprise.
We have never gotten along, my brother and I. He has always been too ambitious for that. And yet, I had hoped.
He waves his hand around, dismissing whatever he was about to say.
Poison may be a coward's weapon, but it is an effective one.
What about Princess Elowen? I ask. And then wish I could take back the question. Poison for her, too, probably. Queen Orla must have a cartload of it. This time, Dane doesn't answer me.
Maybe Baelkin plans on marrying her,
the Roach says, surprising us both. At our expressions, he shrugs.
What? If he makes things too obvious, he's going to be the next one to get a knife in the back. And he wouldn't be the first member of the gentry to wed a sister.
If he marries her,
Dane says, laughing for the first time in this conversation.
He'll get a knife in the front.
I had always thought of Elowen as the gentle sister. Again, I am aware of how little I really know about the world I am trying to navigate.
Come,
says the Roach, waving me to my feet.
It's time you met the others.
I cast a plaintive look in Dane's direction. I don't want to go with the Roach, whom I have just met, and whom I am not at all sure I trust. Even I, who have grown up in the house of a redcap, fear goblins.
Before you go,
Dane walks over until he's standing directly in front of me.
I promised that none might compel you, save for me. I am afraid I'm going to have to use that power. Jude Duarte, I forbid you from speaking aloud about your service to me. I forbid you from putting it into writing or into song. You will never tell anyone of the Roach. You will never tell anyone of any of my spies. You will never reveal their secrets, their meeting places, their safe houses. So long as I live, you will obey this.
I am wearing my necklace of rowan berries, but they are no protection against the magic of the Gesh. This is no regular glamour, no simple sorcery. The weight of the Gesh slams down on me, and I know that if I tried to speak, my mouth wouldn't be able to form those forbidden words. I hate it. It's an awful, out-of-control feeling. It makes me scramble around in my head, trying to imagine my way around his commandment, but I cannot. I think of my first ride to Faerie, and the sound of Taryn and Vivi wailing. I think of Maddox's grim expression, jaw locked, doubtlessly unused to children, no less human ones. His ears must have been ringing. He must have wanted us to shut up. It's hard to think anything good about Maddox in that moment, with our parents' heart's blood on his hands. But I will say this for him. He never enchanted away our grief or took our voices. He never did any of the things that might have made the trip easier for him. I try to convince myself that Prince Dane is only doing the smart thing, the necessary thing, in binding me. But it makes my skin crawl. For a moment, I am unsure of my decision to serve him.
Oh,
Dane says as I'm about to leave.
One more thing. Do you know what Mithridatism is?
I shake my head. Not sure I am interested in anything he has to say right now.
Look into it.
He smiles.
That's not a command, only a suggestion.
I follow the roach through the palace, keeping back from him a few steps so it doesn't seem like we're together. We pass a general Matic nose, and I make sure to keep my head bowed. I don't think he would look closely enough to recognize me, but I cannot be sure.
Where are we going?
I whisper after several minutes of walking through the halls.
Just a little further,
he says gruffly, opening a cupboard and climbing inside. His eyes reflect orange, like a bear's.
Well, come on, get in and close the door.
I can't see in the dark, I remind him, because that is one of the many things the folk never remember about us. He grunts. I get in, folding myself up tightly so that no part of me touches him, and then I close the cabinet door behind me. I hear the slide of wood and feel the rush of cold, damp air. The scent of wet stone fills the space. His hand on my arm is careful, but I can feel his claws. I let him pull me forward, allow him to press my head so I know when to duck. When I straighten out, I am on a narrow platform above what appears to be the palace's wine cellars. My eyes are still adjusting, but from what I can see, there is a network of passageways worming below the palace. I wonder how many people know about them. I smile at the thought of having a secret about this place. Me. Of all people. I wonder if Matic knows. I bet Cardin doesn't. I grin, wider than before.
Enough gopping?
The roach asks.
I can wait.
Are you ready to tell me anything? I ask him. Like, where we're going, or what's going to happen when we get there?
Figure it out,
he says, the growl in his voice.
Go on.
You said we were going to meet the others, I tell him, starting with what I know, trying to keep up and avoid stumbling on the uneven ground. And Prince Dane made me promise not to reveal any hidden locations, so obviously we're going to your lair. But that doesn't tell me what we're going to do when we get there.
Maybe we're going to show you secret handshakes,
the roach says. He's doing something I can't quite see. But a moment later, I hear a click. As though a lock was tripped or a trap disarmed. A gentle shove against the small of my back, and I'm heading down a new, even more dimly lit tunnel. I know when we come to a door, because I walk straight into it, much to the roach's amusement.
You really can't see,
he says. I rub my forehead. I told you I couldn't.
Yes, but you're the liar,
he reminds me.
I'm not supposed to believe anything you say.
Why would I lie about something like that? I demand, still annoyed. He lets my question hang in the air. The answer is obvious, so I could retrace my steps. So he might accidentally show me something he wouldn't show someone else, so that he would be incautious. I really need to stop asking stupid questions. And maybe he really needs to be less paranoid, since Dane put a gesh on me so I can't tell anyone no matter what. The roach opens the door. The light floods the hallway, causing me to throw my arm up in front of my face. Blinking, I look into the secret lair of Prince Dane's spies. It's packed earth on all four sides, with walls that curve inward and a rounded ceiling. A large table dominates the room, and sitting at it are two fairies I've never met. Both of them gazing at me, unhappily.
Welcome,
says the roach,
to the Court of Shadows.
Chapter 14.
The two other members of Dane's spy troop also have code names. There's the lean, handsome fairy that looks at least part human, who winks and tells me to call him the Ghost. He has sandy-colored hair, which is normal for a mortal, but it is unusual for a fairy, and ears that come to very subtle points. The other is a tiny, delicate girl, her skin the dappled brown of a doe, her hair a cloud of white around her head, and a miniature pair of blue-gray butterfly wings on her back. She's got at least some pixie in her, if not some imp. I recognize her now from the High King's full moon revel. She's the one who stole a belt from an ogre, weapons and pouches attached.
"I'm the bomb," she says. "I like blowing things up."
I nod. It's the kind of blunt thing I don't expect fairies to say, but I'm used to being around court fairies with their Baroque etiquette. I'm not used to the solitary fae. I'm at a loss as to how to speak with them. "So, is it just the three of you?"
"For now," says the roach. "We make sure Prince Dane stays alive and well informed about the doings of the court. We steal, sneak, and deceive to secure his coronation. And when he is king, we will steal, sneak, and deceive to make sure he stays on the throne."
I nod. After seeing what Baelkin is like, I want Dane on the throne more than ever. Matic will be by his side. And if I can make myself useful enough, maybe they'll get the rest of the gentry off my back.
"You can do two things the rest of us can't,"
the roach says.
"One, you can blend in with the human servants. Two, you can move among the gentry. We're going to teach you some other tricks. So until you get another mission directly from the prince, your job is what I say it is."
I nod. I expected something like that. I can't always get away. I skipped classes today, but I can't do that all the time, or someone will notice and ask where I've been. And Matic expects me to have dinner with him and Oriana and the rest of the family around midnight. The roach looks over at the ghost and shrugs.
"This is always the problem with infiltrating the court. Lots of etiquette taking up time. When can you get away?"
"I could sneak out after I'm supposed to be in bed," I tell them.
"Good enough,"
the roach says.
"One of us will meet you near the house and either train you or give you assignments. You need not always come here to the nest."
The ghost nods, as though my problems are reasonable. Part of the job. But I feel childish. They are a child's problems.
"So, let's initiate her," the bomb says, walking up to me.
I catch my breath. Whatever happens next, I can endure it. I have endured more than they can guess. But the bomb only starts laughing, and the roach gives her a playful shove. The ghost gives me a sympathetic look and shakes his head. His eyes, I notice, are a shifting hazel.
"If Prince Dane says you are part of the Court of Shadows, then you are. Try not to be too much of a disappointment, and we'll have your back."
I let out my breath. I'm not sure that I wouldn't have preferred some ordeal, some way to prove myself. The bomb makes a face.
"You'll know you're really one of us when you get your name. Don't expect it any time soon."
The ghost goes over to a cabinet and takes out a half-empty bottle of a pale greenish liquid and a stack of polished acorn cups. He pours out four shots.
"Have a drink, and don't worry,"
he tells me.
"It won't befuddle you any more than any other drink."
I shake my head, thinking of the way I felt after having the golden apple mashed into my face. Never do I want to feel out of control like that again. I'll pass. The roach knocks back his drink and makes a face, as though the liquor is scorching his throat.
"Suit yourself,"
he manages to choke out before he starts to cough. The ghost barely winces at the contents of his acorn.
The bomb is taking tiny sips of hers. From her expression, I am extra glad I passed on it.
Belkin's going to be a problem,
the roach says, explaining what I found. The bomb puts down her acorn. I mislike everything about this. If he was going to go to Eldred, he would have done it already. I had not considered that he might poison his father. The ghost stretches his lanky body as he gets up.
It's getting late. I should take the girl home.
Jude, I remind him. He grins.
I know a shortcut.
We go back into the tunnels, and following him is a challenge because, as his name suggests, he moves almost completely silently. Several times, I think he's left me alone in the tunnels. But just when I'm about to stop walking, I hear the faintest exhalation of breath or shuffle of dirt and persuade myself to go on. After what feels like an agonizingly long time, a doorway opens. The ghost is standing in it, and beyond him is the High King's wine cellar. He makes a small bow. This is your shortcut? I ask. He winks.
If a few bottles happen to fall into my satchel as we pass through, that's hardly my fault, is it?
I force out a laugh, the sound creaky and false in my ears. I'm not used to one of the folk including me in their jokes, at least not outside my family. I like to believe that I'm doing okay here in Faerie. I like to believe that even though I was drugged and nearly murdered at school yesterday, I am able to put that behind me today. I'm fine. But if I can't laugh, maybe I'm not so fine after all. I change into the blue shift I packed in the woods outside Maddox's grounds, despite being so tired that my joints hurt. I wonder if the folk are ever tired like that, if they ever ache after a long evening. The toad seems exhausted, too, although maybe she's just full. As far as I can tell, most of what she did today was snap her tongue at passing butterflies and a mouse or two. It's full deep dark when I get back to the estate. The trees are lit with tiny sprites, and I see a laughing oak racing through them, pursued by Vivi and Taryn, and, oh hell, Locke. It's disorienting to see him here, impossibly out of context. Has he come because of me? With a shriek, Oak dashes over, clambering up the saddlebags and onto my lap.
Chase me!
He yells, out of breath, full of the wriggling ecstasy of childhood. Even fairies are young once. Impulsively, I hug him to my chest. He's warm, and smells of grass and deep woods. He lets me do it for a moment, small arms twining around my neck. Small horned head butting against my chest. Then, laughing, he slides down and away, throwing a puckish glance back to see if I'll follow. Growing up here in Faerie, will he learn to scorn mortals? When I am old and he is still young, will he scorn me too? Will he become cruel like Cardan? Will he become brutal like Matic? I have no way of knowing. I step off the toad, foot in the stirrup as I swing my body down. I pat just above her nose. Her golden eyes drift shut. In fact, she seems a little like she might be asleep until I yank on the reins, leading her back toward the stables. Hello, Locke says, jogging up to me. Now, where might you have gone off to? None of your business, I tell him. But I soften the words with a smile. I can't help it.
Ah, a lady of mystery. My favorite kind.
He's wearing a green doublet, with slits to show his silk shirt underneath. His fox eyes are alight. He looks like a fairy lover stepped out of a ballad, the kind where no good comes to the girl who runs away with him.
I hope you'll consider returning to classes tomorrow,
he says. Vivi continues to chase Oak. But Taryn has stopped near a large elm tree. She watches me with the same expression she had on the tournament field.
as though if she concentrates hard enough, she can will me into not offending Locke.
You mean so your friends know they haven't chased me off, I say? Does it matter?
He looks at me oddly.
You're playing the great game of kings and princes, of queens and crowns, aren't you? Of course it matters. Everything matters.
I am not sure how to interpret his words. I didn't think I was playing that kind of game at all. I thought I was playing the game of pissing off people who hated me already and eating the consequences.
Come back. You and Taryn both should return. I told her so.
I turn my head, looking for my twin in the yard. But she is no longer by the elm. Vivi and Oak are disappearing over a hill. Perhaps she has gone with them. We get to the stables, and I return the toad to her pen. I fill her water station from a barrel in the center of the room, and a fine mist appears, raining down on her soft skin. The horses nicker and stamp as we leave. Locke watches this all in silence.
May I ask you something else?
Locke says, glancing in the direction of the manor. I nod.
Why haven't you told your father what's been happening?
Maddox stables are very impressive. Maybe standing in them, Locke was reminded of just how much power and influence the general has. But that doesn't mean I am the inheritor of that power. Maybe Locke should also remember that I am merely one of the by-blow children of Maddox's human wife. Without Maddox and his honor, no one would care about me.
You mean so he can go stomping into our classes with a broadsword, killing everyone in sight?
I ask, instead of correcting Locke about my station in life. Locke's eyes widen.
I guess that wasn't what he meant. I thought that your father would pull you out, and that if you didn't tell him, it was because you wanted to stay.
I give a short laugh. That's not what he'll do at all. Maddox is not a fan of surrender. In the cool dark of the stables, with the snorting of fairy horses all around us, he takes my hands.
Nothing there will be the same without you.
Since I never intended to quit, it's nice to have someone making all this effort to get me to do something I would have done anyway. And the way he's looking at me, the intensity of it, is so nice that I am embarrassed. No one has ever looked at me this way. I can feel the heat of my cheeks and wonder if the shadows help cover it up at all. Right then, I feel as though he sees everything, every hope of my heart, every stray thought I've had before falling into an exhausted sleep each dawn. He brings one of my hands up to his mouth and presses his lips against my palm. My whole body tenses. I am suddenly too warm, too everything. His breath is a soft susurration against my skin. With a gentle tug, he pulls me closer. His arm is around me. He leans in for a kiss, and my thoughts slide away. This can't be happening.
Jude?
I hear Taryn call uncertainly from nearby, and I stagger away from Locke.
Jude, are you still in the stable?
Here, I say, my face hot. We emerge into the night to find Oriana on the steps of the house, hauling Oak inside. Vivi is waving to him as he tries to squirm free from his mother's grip. Taryn has her hands on her hips.
Oriana has called everyone in to dinner,
Taryn informs us both grandly. She wants Locke to stay and eat with us. He makes a bow.
You may inform your lady mother that though I am honored to be asked to her table, I would not so impose myself on her. I only wanted to speak with you both. I will, however, call again. You may be sure of that.
You talked to Jude about school?
There's trepidation in Taryn's voice. I wonder what they spoke about before I returned. I wonder if he persuaded her to attend the lectures again. And if so, how he did it.
Until tomorrow,
he says to us with a wink. I watch him walk off, still overwhelmed. I don't dare look at Taryn, for fear she will see all of it on my face. The whole day's events. The almost kiss. I am not ready to talk, so I am the one who avoids her for once. Skipping up the steps with as much nonchalance as I can muster, I head to my room to change for dinner. I forgot that I asked Matic to teach me swordplay and strategy. But after dinner, he gives me a stack of military history books from his personal library.
"When you're done reading these, we will talk,"
he informs me.
"I will set you a series of challenges, and you will tell me how you might overcome them with the resources I give you."
I think he expects me to object and insist on more swordplay, but I am too tired to even think of it. Flopping down on my bed an hour later, I decide that I am not going to even take off the blue silk dress I am wearing. My hair is still disarranged, although I tried to improve it with a few pretty pins. I should take those out at least, I tell myself, but I can't seem to make any movement toward doing so. My door opens, and Taryn comes in, hopping up onto my bed.
"Okay," she says, poking me in the side. "What did Locke want?"
"He said he had to talk to you." "He's nice," I say, rolling over and folding my arms behind my head, staring up at the folds of fabric gathered above me. Not totally Cardin's puppet like the rest of them. Taryn has an odd expression on her face, like she wants to contradict me, but is holding herself back.
"Whatever. Spill."
"About Locke?" I ask. She rolls her eyes.
"About what happened with him and his friends."
"They're never going to respect me if I don't fight back," I tell her. She sighs.
"They're never going to respect you, period."
I think of crawling across the grass, my knees dirty, the savor of the fruit in my mouth. Even now I can taste the echo of it, the emptiness it would fill, the giddy, delirious joy it promises. Taryn goes on.
"You came home practically naked yesterday, smeared with fairy fruit. Isn't that bad enough? Don't you care?"
Taryn has pulled her whole body back against one of the posts of my bed. "I am tired of caring," I say.
"Why should I?" "Because they could kill you."
"They better," I say to her. "Because anything less than that isn't going to work."
"Do you have a plan for stopping them?" she asks. "You said you were going to defy Cardin by being your awesome self, and if he tried to take you down, you'd take him down with you. How are you going to manage that?"
"I don't know exactly," I admit. She throws up her hands in frustration. "No, look," I say. "Every day that I don't beg Cardin for forgiveness over a feud he started is a day I win. He can humiliate me, but every time he does and I don't back down, he makes himself less powerful. After all, he's throwing everything he's got at someone as weak as I am, and it's not working. He's going to take himself down." She sighs and comes over to me, laying her head against my chest, putting her arms around me. Against my shoulder, she whispers, "He's Flint. You're Tinder." I hug her closer and make no promises. We stay like that for a long moment.
"Did Locke threaten you?"
she asks softly.
"It was so odd that he came here looking for you, and then you had such a weird expression when I walked into the stables."
"No, nothing bad," I tell her. "I don't know exactly what he came for, but he kissed my hand. It was nice, like out of a storybook."
"Nice things don't happen in storybooks," Taryn says.
"Or when they do happen, something bad happens next. Because otherwise, the story would be boring, and no one would read it." It's my turn to sigh. I know it's stupid, thinking well of one of Cardin's friends. But he really did help me. He stood up to Cardin. But I'd rather talk about you,
There's someone, isn't there? When you said you were going to fall in love, you were talking about someone in particular. Not that I'd be the first to green gown her. There's a boy, she says slowly. He's going to declare himself at Prince Dane's coronation. He's going to ask for my hand from Matic. And then everything is going to change for me. I think of her weeping, standing beside Cardin. I think of how angry she's been that I am feuding with him. I think of that, and a cold and terrible dread creeps over me. Who? I demand. Please not Cardin. Anyone but Cardin. I promise not to tell anyone, she says. Even you. Our promises don't matter, I say, thinking of Prince Dane's Gesh still freezing my tongue, of how little any of them trust us. No one expects us to have any honor. Everyone knows we lie. She gives me a stern, disapproving look. It's a fairy prohibition. If I break it, he'll know. I need to show him I can live like one of the folk.
Okay, I say slowly.
Be happy for me, she says. And I feel cut to the quick. She has found her place in fairy, and I guess I have found mine. But I can't help worrying. Just tell me something about him. Tell me that he is kind. Tell me that you love him, and that he's promised to be good to you. Tell me. He's a fairy, she says. They don't love the way we do. And I think you would like him. There. That's something. That doesn't sound like Cardin, whom I despise. But I am not sure I can find her answer reassuring either. What does it mean, I would like him? Does that mean we've never met? What does it mean that he doesn't love the way we do? I am happy for you. Honest, I say. Although I am more worried than anything. This is exciting. When Oriana's dressmaker comes, you're going to have to make sure you get an extra pretty gown. Taryn relaxes. I just want everything to be better. For both of us. I reach over to my bedside table to retrieve the book I stole from Hollow Hall. Remember this? I ask, lifting up the collected Alice's Adventures in Wonderland book. When I do, a folded piece of paper slips out and flutters to the floor. We used to read that when we were little, she says, grabbing for the book. Where did you get it? I found it, I say, not able to explain whose bookshelf it had come from or why I had been in Hollow Hall in the first place. To test the Gesh, I try to say the words, spying for Prince Dane. My mouth will not move. My tongue stays still. A wave of panic washes over me, but I push it back. This is a small price for what he's given me. Taryn doesn't press for more information. She's too busy flipping through the pages and reading bits of it aloud. While I can't quite remember the cadence of my mother's voice, I think I hear an echo of it in Taryn's. Now here, you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place, she reads. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that. I reach down surreptitiously and shove the fallen paper under my pillow. I plan to unfold it once she returns to her room, but instead I fall asleep, long before the story is over. I wake in the early morning, alone, needing to pee. I pad into my bath area, lift my skirts, and do my business in the copper basin left there for this purpose. Shame heating my face, even though I am alone. It is one of the most humbling aspects of being human. I know that fairies are not gods. Maybe I know that better than any mortal alive. But neither have I ever seen one hunched over a bedpan. Back in bed, I push aside the curtain and let the sunlight spill in, brighter than any lamp. I take the folded-up paper from behind my pillow. Smoothing it out, I see Cardin's furious, arrogant handwriting scrawled over the page.
taking up all available space. In some places, he pressed the nib so angrily that the paper tore. "Jude," it reads. "Each hateful rendering of my name, like a punch to the gut. Jude, 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 Jude.
Chapter 15. The dressmaker comes early the next afternoon, a long-fingered fairy called Brambleweft. Her feet are turned backward, giving her an odd gait. Her eyes are like those of a goat, brown with a horizontal line of black just at the center. She is wearing an example of her work, a woven dress with embroidered lines of thorns making a striped pattern down the length of it. She has brought with her bolts of fabric, some of it stiff gold, one that changes color like iridescent beetle wings. Beside that, she tells us, is a spider silk so fine that it could have fit through the eye of a needle 3 times over, and yet strong enough to have to be cut with silver scissors magicked to never lose their edge. The purple fabric shot through with gold and silver is so bright that it seems like moonlight itself puddling over the cushions. All the fabrics are draped onto the couch in Oriana's parlor for us to inspect. Even Vivi is drawn to run her fingers over the cloth, an absent smile on her face. There is nothing like this in the mortal world, and she knows it. Oriana's current maid, a hairy, wizened creature named Toadfoss, brings tea and cakes, meat and jam, all piled on a massive silver tray. I pour myself tea and drink it without cream, hoping it will settle my stomach. The terror of the last few days is at my heels, making me shudder without warning. The memory of the fairy fruit keeps rising unbidden to my tongue, along with the cracked lips of the servants in Baelkin's palace, and the sound of the leather as it struck Prince Cardin's bare back. And my own name, written over and over and over. I thought I knew how much Cardin hated me. But looking at that paper, I realized I had no idea. And he'd hate me even more still if he knew I had seen him on his knees, beaten by a human servant. A mortal. For an extra bit of humiliation. An extra dose of rage. "Jude?" Oriana says, and I realize that I've been staring off toward the window and the fading light. "Yes?" I put on a bright, false smile. Taryn and Vivienne begin to laugh. "And just who are you thinking about with a dreamy expression like that on your face?" Oriana asks, which makes Vivi laugh again. Taryn doesn't, probably because she thinks I am an idiot. I shake my head, hoping I have not gone red-faced. "No, it wasn't anything like that. I was just... I don't know. It doesn't matter. What were we talking about?" "The seamstress wishes to measure you first," Oriana says, "since you're the youngest." I look over at Brambleweft, who holds a string between her hands. I hop up onto the box she has set before her, holding out my arms. I am a good daughter today. I am going to get a pretty gown. I will dance at Prince Dane's coronation until my feet bleed.
"Don't scowl,"
the seamstress says. Before I can stammer apologies, she continues, voice pitched low.
"I was told to sew this dress with pockets that can conceal weapons and poisons and other little necessities. We'll make sure that's done while still showing you to great advantage."
I almost stumble off the box. I am so surprised. "That's wonderful," I whisper back, knowing better than to thank her.
Fairies don't believe in dismissing gratitude with a few words. They believe in debts and bargains. And the person I am meant to be most indebted to is not here. Prince Dane is the one who expects to be repaid. She smiles, pins in her mouth, and I grin back at her. I will repay him. Although it seems I will have much to repay him for, I will make him proud of me. Everyone else, I will make very, very sorry. When I look up, Vivi is watching me suspiciously. Taryn is next to be measured. As she gets on the box, I go and drink more tea. Then I eat 3 sugary cakes and a strip of ham.
"Where did you go the other day?"
Vivi asks as I gulp down the meat like some kind of raptor bird. I have woken ravenous. I think of how I fled from our conversation on my way to Hollow Hall. I can't exactly deny that, not without explaining more about where I was going than my geshed tongue will allow. I shrug, one-shouldered.
"I made one of the other gentry kids describe what happened to you at that lecture," Vivi says. "You could have died. The only reason you're alive is that they didn't want their game to be over."
"That's the way they are," I remind her. "That's the way things are. Do you want the world to be different than it is? Because this is the world we get, Vivi."
"It's not the only world," she says softly.
"It's my world," I say, my heart hammering in my chest. I stand before she can tell me otherwise. My hands are shaking, though, and my palms are sweaty when I go to finger the fabrics. Ever since I staggered home through the woods in my underwear, I have been trying to feel nothing about what happened. I am afraid that if I begin to feel, I won't be able to bear it. I am afraid that the emotion will be like a wave sucking me under. It's not the first awful thing I have endured and pushed it into the back of my brain. That's how I've been coping, and if there's another, better way, I do not know it. I focus my attention on the cloth until I can breathe evenly again, until the panic dissipates. There's a velvet blue-green, reminding me of the lake at dusk. I find an amazing, fantastical fabric embroidered with moths and butterflies and ferns and flowers. I lift it up, and underneath is a bolt of beautiful fog-gray cloth that ripples like smoke. They're so very pretty. The kind of fabrics that princesses in fairy tales wear. Of course, Taryn is right about stories. Bad things happen to those princesses. They are pricked with thorns, poisoned by apples, married to their own fathers. They have their hands cut off, and their brothers turned into swans, their lovers chopped up and planted in basil pots. They vomit up diamonds. When they walk, it feels as though they're walking on knives. They still manage to look nice.
"I want that one,"
Taryn says, pointing to the bolt of fabric I'm holding, the one with the embroidery. She's done being measured. Vivi is up there, holding out her arms, watching me in that unnerving way she has, as though she knows my very thoughts.
"Your sister found it first," Oriana says.
"Please,"
Taryn says to me, bending her head and looking up through her eyelashes. She's joking, but she's not. She needs to look nice for this boy who is supposed to declare himself at the coronation. She doesn't understand what use my looking nice would be, me with my grudges and feuds. With a half-smile, I set down the bolt. "Sure, all yours." Taryn kisses me on the cheek. I guess we're back to normal. If only everything in my life were so easily resolved. I choose a different cloth, the dark blue velvet.
Vivienne chooses a violet that seems to be a silvery gray when she turns it over her hand.
Oriana chooses a blush pink for herself and a cricket green for Oak. Brambleweft starts to sketch. billowing skirts and cunning little capes, corsets stitched with fanciful creatures, butterflies alighting along arms and in elaborate headpieces. I am charmed at the alien vision of myself. My corset will have two golden beetles stitched in what looks like a breastplate, with Maddox moon crest and elaborate swirls of shining thread continuing down my front, and tiny sheer drop sleeves of more gold. It will certainly be clear to what household I belong. We are still making small changes when Oak runs in, being chased by Gnarbone. Oak spots me first and scrambles onto my lap, throwing his arms around my neck and giving me a small bite just beneath my shoulder. "Ow!" I say in surprise, but he just laughs. It makes me laugh, too. He's kind of a weird kid, maybe because he's a fairy, or maybe because all kids, human or inhuman, are equally weird. Do you want me to tell you a story about a little boy who bit a stone and lost all his pearly white teeth? I ask him in what I hope is a menacing fashion, sticking my fingers under his armpits to tickle him. "Yes!" he says immediately between breathless giggles and shrieks. Oriana strides over to us, her face full of trouble. "That's very kind of you, but we ought to begin dressing for dinner." She pulls him off my lap and into her arms. He begins screaming and kicking his legs. One of the kicks lands against my stomach, hard enough to bruise, but I don't say anything.
"Story!"
he shouts.
"I want the story!"
"Jude is busy right now," she says, carrying his squirming body toward the door, where Gnarbone is waiting to take him back to the nursery. "Why don't you ever trust me with him?" I shout, and Oriana wheels around, shocked that I said a thing we don't say. I am shocked, too, but I can't stop. "I'm not a monster! I've never done anything to either of you!"
"I want the story!"
Oak whines, sounding confused. "That's enough," Oriana says sternly, as though we've all been arguing. "We will speak about this later with your father." With that, she strides from the room. "I don't know whose father you're talking about, because he's sure not mine," I call after her. Taryn's eyes go saucer wide.
Vivienne has a small smile on her face.
She takes a minute sip of tea, and then she raises the cup in my direction in salute. The seamstress is looking down and away, leaving us to our private family moment. I cannot seem to contort myself back into the shape of a dutiful child. I am coming unraveled. I am coming undone. The next day at school, Taryn walks beside me, swinging her lunch basket. I keep my head high and my jaw set. I have my little knife with me, cold iron, tucked into one of the pockets of my skirt, and more salt than I reasonably need. I even have a new necklace of rowan berries, sewn by Tatterfell and worn because there was no way she could know I didn't need it. I dally in the palace garden to gather a few more things.
"Are you allowed to pick those?"
Taryn asks, but I do not answer her. In the afternoon, we attend a lecture in a high tower, where we are taught about bird songs. Every time I feel as though my courage will falter, I let my fingers brush the cool metal of the blade. Locke looks over, and when he catches my eye, he winks. From the other side of the room, Cardin scowls at the lecturer, but does not speak. When he moves to take an inkpot from a satchel, I see him wince. I think about how sore his back must be, how it must hurt to move. But if he holds himself a little more stiffly as he sneers, that seems to be the only difference in his manner. He looks well practiced in hiding pain. I think of the note I found, of the press of his nibbed pen hard enough to send flecks of ink spattering as he wrote my name, hard enough to dig through the page, maybe to scar the desk beneath. If that's what he did to the paper, I shudder to think what he wants to do to me. After school, I practice with Matic. He shows me a particularly clever block, and I do it over and over again, better and faster, surprising even him. When I go inside, covered in sweat, I pass Oak, who is running somewhere, dragging my stuffed snake after him on a dirty rope. He's clearly stolen the snake from my room. Oak! I call after him, but he's up the stairs and away. I sluice off in my bath and then, alone in my room, unpack my school bag. Tucked down in the bottom, wrapped in a leftover piece of paper, is a single worm-eaten fairy fruit I picked up on the way home. I set it on a tray and pull on leather gloves. Then I take out my knife and cut it into pieces. Tiny slivers of squishy golden fruit. I have researched fairy poisons in dusty, hand-scribed books in Maddox's library. I read about the blusher mushroom, a pale fungus that blooms with beads of a red liquid that looks uncomfortably like blood. Small doses cause paralysis, while large doses are lethal, even for the folk. Then there is death sweet, which causes a sleep that lasts 100 years, and wraithberry, which makes your blood race until your heart stops, and fairy fruit, of course, which one book called Everapple. I take out a flask of pine liquor, nicked from the kitchens, thick and heavy as sap. I drop the fruit into it to keep it fresh. My hands are shaking. The final piece, I put on my tongue. The rush of it hits me hard, and I grit my teeth against it. Then, while I'm feeling stupid, I take out the other things. A leaf of wraithberry from the palace garden. A petal from a flower of death sweet. The tiniest bead of juice from the blusher mushroom. From each, I cut away a tinier portion and swallow. Mithridatism, it's called. Isn't that a funny name? The process of eating poison to build up immunity. So long as I don't die from it, I'll be harder to kill. I do not make it downstairs for dinner. I am too busy retching, too busy shivering and sweating. I fall asleep on the bath area of my room, spread out on the floor. That's where the ghost finds me. I wake to his poking me in the stomach with the foot of his boot. It's only grogginess that keeps me from crying out. "Rise, Jude," the ghost says. "The roach wants you to train tonight." I push myself up, too exhausted to disobey. Outside, on the dewy grass, with the first rays of sun creeping across the island, the ghost shows me how to climb trees silently. How to put down a foot without snapping a branch or crackling a dried leaf. I thought I'd learned how in my lessons at the palace, but he shows me mistakes my teachers didn't bother correcting. I try, over and over. Mostly, I fail. "Good," he says, once my muscles are shaking. He's spoken so little that his voice startles me. He could more easily pass for human than Vivi, with the subtler points on his ears, light brown hair, and hazel eyes. And yet, he seems unknowable to me, both calmer and colder than she is. The sun is almost up. The leaves are turning gold. "Keep practicing. Sneak up on your sisters." When he grins, with sandy hair falling over his face, he seems younger than I am. But I'm sure he's not. And when he goes, he does it in such a way that it appears like vanishing. I head back home and use what I've just learned to slyfoot my way past the servants on the stairs. I make it to my room, and this time, when I collapse, I manage to do it in my bed. Then I get up the next day and do everything all over again. Chapter 16. Attending lectures is harder than ever. For one thing, I am sick,
my body fighting the effects of the fruit and the poisons I am forcing down. For another, I am exhausted from training with Matic and training with Dane's Court of Shadows. Matic gives me puzzles. 12 goblin knights to storm a fortress, 9 untrained gentry to defend one, and then asks for my answers each evening after dinner. The Roach orders me to practice moving through the crowds of courtiers without being noticed, to eavesdrop without seeming interested. The Balm teaches me how to find the weak spot in a building, the pressure point on a body. The Ghost teaches me how to hang from rafters and not be seen, to line up a shot with a crossbow, to steady my shaking hands. I am sent on 2 more missions to get information. First, I steal a letter addressed to Elowen from a knight's desk in the palace. The next time, I wear the clothing of a fairy bride and walk through a party to the private chambers of the lovely Terrakand, one of Prince Baelkin's consorts, where I take a ring from a desk. In neither case am I allowed to know the significance of what I stole. I attend lectures beside Cardin, Nicasia, Valerian, and all the gentry children who laughed at my humiliation. I do not give them the satisfaction of my withdrawing. But since the incident with the fairy fruit, there are no more skirmishes. I bide my time. I can only assume they are doing the same. I am not foolish enough to think we are done with one another. Locke continues his flirtation. He sits with Taryn and me when we take our lunch, spread out on a blanket, watching the sunset. Occasionally, he walks me home through the woods, stopping to kiss me near a copse of fir trees just before Maddox's estate. I only hope he doesn't taste the bitterness of poison on my lips. I do not understand why he likes me, but it is exciting to be liked. Taryn doesn't seem to understand it either. She regards Locke with suspicion. Perhaps since I am worried over her mysterious paramour, it is fitting that she seems equally worried over mine.
"Are you enjoying yourself?"
I overhear Nicasia ask Locke once as he joins them for a lecture.
"Cardin won't forgive you for what you're doing with her."
I pause, unable to pass by without listening for his answer. But Locke only laughs.
"Is he more angry that you chose me over him, or that I chose a mortal over you?"
I startle, not sure I heard him right. She's about to answer when she spots me. Her mouth curls.
"Little mousy," she says. "Don't believe his sugared tongue."
The Roach would despair of me if he saw how badly I fumbled my newfound skills. I did nothing he taught me. I neither concealed myself nor blended in with others to avoid notice. At least no one would suspect me of knowing much about spycraft. "So has Cardin forgiven you?" I ask her, pleased by her stricken look. "Too bad. I hear a prince's favor is a really big deal."
"What need have I for princes?"
she demands.
"My mother is a queen."
There's much I could say about her mother, Queen Orla, who is planning a poisoning, but I bite my tongue. In fact, I bite it so hard that I don't say anything at all. I just walk to where Taryn is sitting, a small, satisfied smile on my face. More weeks pass until the coronation is mere days away. I am so tired that I fall asleep whenever I put my head down. I even fall asleep in the tower during a demonstration of moth summoning. The susurration of their wings lulls me, I guess. It doesn't take much. I wake on the stone floor. My head is ringing, and I am scrambling for my knife. I don't know where I am. For a moment, I think that I must have fallen. For a moment, I think I am paranoid. Then I see Valerian, grinning down at me. He has pushed me out of my chair. I know it just from the look on his face. I have not yet become paranoid enough. Voices sound from outside, the rest of our classmates having their luncheon on the grass as evening rolls in. I hear the shrieks of the youngest children, probably chasing one another over blankets. Where's Taryn? I ask, because it wasn't like her not to wake me.
She promised not to help you, remember?
Valyrian's golden hair hangs over one eye. As usual, he's clad entirely in red, a tone so deep that it might appear black at first glance.
Not by word or by deed.
Of course. Stupid me to forget I was on my own. I push myself up, noticing a bruise on my calf as I do. I am not sure how long I was sleeping. I brush off my tunic and trousers. What do you want?
I'm disappointed,
he says slyly.
You bragged about how you were going to best Cardin, and yet you've done nothing, sulking after one little prank.